we're up to chapter 24. Does anybody need notes? Everybody's good. Wow. So we want to talk about this boiling pot. Okay. Want to call it a kettle? That's up to you. Same basic idea, right? Kind of like a canning. Think of those. Then you boil your water and do your canning in those, right? Same basic thing. This one's made out of, depending on how you interpret this, the Hebrew word, it's either copper, bronze, or brass. So those are all very similar, but a little bit different. But nonetheless, the point is, it probably one time was really shiny, okay? Right? And it was probably kind of expensive. There was years ago a special, and don't ask me who put it out, but there was a special about the copper mines in the Middle East and how they were the miners were suspended by ropes and all underground doing this chipping away, and it was quite the process. I think the Book of Job talks about it, if I remember correctly. But we have here in Babylon, wherever they got their copper, God gives to Ezekiel a additional revelation, and we see it on the bottom of page 30 of your notes, or I guess more accurately, the top of page 31. In chapter 24, verses 1 and 2, the word of Yahweh came to me in the ninth year, in the tenth month, on the tenth of the month. Son of man, write the name of the day, this very day. The king of Babylon has laid siege to Jerusalem this very day. And again, this is that final, what seems to be the final attack against Jerusalem. But there's nothing he can do about it, right? There's nothing Ezekiel can do. And we say in American English, we say, well, I know I can't do anything, or is there something I can do besides prayer? Right? And I know what we mean by that, and I've said it myself, but you know, sometimes you think, it's like, well, do we minimize prayer that much, right? It's just prayer. But Ezekiel can only pray, right, in one sense. And God says, well, let's give you something else to do besides prayer, verses 3 through 5. He says, speak a parable to the rebellious house, and you will say to them, thus says Adonai, Yahweh, the sovereign Yahweh. Put on the pot, put it on, and also pour water in it. Put in it the pieces, every good piece, the thigh and the shoulder. Fill it with choice bones. Take the choicest of the flock, and also pile wood under the pot. Make it seethe or boil vigorously. Also boil its bones in it. Right? And the people in the audience are going, okay, right? I mean, we got a recipe, we got a cookbook kind of laid out for us here on how to make this meal. It's an unusual communication, but it's something they're familiar with. Right, he's taking something they do not every day, because they probably didn't eat meat every day, but they were still familiar with the cooking process. Now, as someone has pointed out, the reason for this poem is perhaps that those who have survived so far were thinking that they were the choice ones. Who were still safe in Jerusalem. In other words, we haven't been taken into captivity because we're better. Okay? We know sinners go into captivity. Yeah. Now, I don't want to say anything. I don't want to be proud or anything, but I'm not in captivity. Right? That's kind of probably the idea here. The choice meat, the choice of the flock. That's meat, right? Because we're still here. Well, again, we all have an experience, and we all interpret our experience. What's the truth? The reality is you're still in Jerusalem. How do you want to interpret that? Right? And that's the issue here. So, lest they misinterpret, Ezekiel says, in essence, God is going to give you the interpretation. Verses 6 through 14. He says this, therefore thus says Adonai Yahweh, woe to the city of blood, to the pot in which there is rust, and whose rust has not gone out of it. And it's kind of like cast iron pans or any other pans that get rusty and nasty, and you look at it and you go, I don't know if I want to cook in that, right? It's you know where that's going. Take out of it piece after piece without making a choice, for her blood is in her midst. She placed it on the bare rock. She did not pour it on the ground to cover it with dust. Thus it may cause wrath to come up to take vengeance. I have put her blood on the bare rock that it may not be covered. In other words, there's judgment coming. And we're not going to hide it. There's nobody there to cover it up, to make you feel better. Verse 9, therefore, thus says Adonai Yahweh, woe to the city of blood. Now that's the second woe in this section, right? That is, it's going to get really, really bad. But also, you are the city of blood. You are the city characterized by shedding blood, right? You are a city of violence, a city of self-orientation, and life is all about you, and you are willing to do whatever needs to be done, even if it means killing your neighbor, right? So not only are you not loving your neighbor as yourself, which is bad, you're also killing your neighbor, right? You've gone that far, right? Does that make sense? You're going the furthest extreme. Woe to the city of blood, I also will make the pile great. Heap on the wood, kindle the fire, completely cook the flesh, mix in the spices, let the bones be burned, and then stand it empty on its coals so that it may be hot and its bronze may glow, and its uncleanness may be melted in it, its rust brought to a complete end. In other words, we're going to melt this down, right? We're going to purify the pot. It's extremely hot. I don't know what the smelting temperature is of this, but the point is, it's going to be taken care of. God is going to deal with it as needs to be done. Verse 12 tells us why. She has wearied me with toil, yet her great rust has not gone from her. Let her rust be in the fire. So you think you're okay? Right? We have an expression in English, right, about the pot calling, what is it? Don't call the pot calling the kettle black, or whatever the expression is, right? It's easy to point at somebody else's rust, right? When we're rusty ourselves. Then he says, let's talk about your rust a little bit. Now, we don't like rust. We don't like rust on our vehicles, right? We don't like rust on a variety of things. Let's talk about your rust, verse 13. In your uncleanness is lewdness. Because I would have cleansed you, yet you are not clean. You will not be cleansed from your uncleanness again until I have caused my wrath against you to be at rest. So not only are you content with your rust, content with your sin, you don't want to be forgiven. You don't want to be cleansed. Now, it's one thing to to say, well, okay, I know I sinned and I'm struggling with sin, and this is a whole nother thing, right? This is, leave my rust alone, right? How dare you be so unloving as to say I have rust and you think there's something wrong with my rust, right? That's the attitude that's here. Leave me alone. Let me have my sin. Let me deal with my sin. Well, if you call it sin, leave my rust alone. God says, I'm going to take care of it, but it's going to be a long process. So, verse 14, how do we know that this will be taken care of? Because I, Yahweh, have spoken. It is coming, and I will act. I will not regret, and I will not pity, and I will not relent. According to your ways and according to your deeds, I will judge you, declares Adonai Yahweh. Now, God is a God who does take pity. He is a God who does show compassion. But what Yahweh is saying is what? That will come to an end, right? Now, that doesn't mean that God stops being compassionate, but he stops displaying that compassion, right? He remains compassionate. He remains a God of pity. He remains a God of love and a God of care for his people, but he's going to deal with their sins. I've typed in there for you a comment from Charles Dyer in the Moody Bible Commentary, who wrote this: while God's mercy prompts him to withhold judgment as long as possible to enable people to repent, he does not wait indefinitely. God will eventually and inevitably punish wickedness. Now, we may not like that. And there are people who struggle with that. But the reality is, God is also a God of justice, right? And a God of holiness and a God of wrath. And that needs to be and will be expressed. Let's back up to, if we can quickly, to the book of Leviticus chapter 17. Now, the illustration that God is talking about here, and I've mentioned this before, that I do think that in the shadows, if you will, of the book of Ezekiel lies the book of Leviticus. So if you're able to see, in a sense, see through Ezekiel, you'll Ezekiel's writings, you'll see that he's thinking, I think, constantly of the book of Leviticus, because he's a priest, and that's what he was raised for. That's his job. That's his life. That's his life. But listen. Leviticus chapter 17 and verse, let's back up to verse 10. And any man from the house of Israel or from the sojourners who sojourn among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people. And why is that? Verse 11, because the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. So again, they were supposed to drain out all the blood from whatever meat they were going to eat. There was health issues involved. It was also a way to distinguish them from the false religions and the dietary practices of the false religions. Verse 12, therefore I said to the sons of Israel, no person among you may eat blood, and no sojourner who sojourns among you may eat blood. So any man from the sons of Israel or from the sojourners who sojourn among you who in hunting catches a beast or a bird which may be eaten, shall pour out its blood. Now listen, this phrase that echoes now in the book of Ezekiel, and cover it with earth. Okay? Wasn't that the issue back in the book of Ezekiel? The blood was going to be uncovered, right? And God wants you to, in the book of Leviticus, he wants them to cover over the blood to make sure that nobody steps in it and make sure it doesn't become a hindrance for anybody. But I think that's what's echoing here in Ezekiel chapter 24. It's a thought that is very difficult for them, that there would somehow be blood that is spilled and not covered up, right? That would show either carelessness or it would show an inability to accomplish what needs to be done. Or at worst, it would show a defiance. I don't care. But God says, you are this rusty pot, and you have contaminated whatever has been put into it, right? That meat, that nice choice meat from the sheep or from the goats that was put in there, and you were hungry and your stomach's been growling, and the sermon's still not over, and you just can't wait to get home to eat that, and then you realize, you know what's in that pot? All that rust, all that contamination. And now, you still want to eat that when you get home? Right? You understand, it contaminates, and it causes harm. And you, Jerusalem, are that pot. And you're full of rust. And you have contaminated anybody who comes in contact with you. Now, he's talking here spiritual contamination. The point is, you were designed to be pure. You were called to be holy unto the Lord, to be holy as he is holy, right? But you're just the opposite. Now you're a contamination rather than a purification. Well, before we move on to this sad couple paragraphs here, verses 15 and following, any questions or comments? It's not earth-shaking things there in the first 14 verses, but go ahead.
I have a side question, but even blood nowadays, what's the restriction on it? It's still there, because New Testament mentions slightly too, right?
Yeah, it carries over, I think, and we don't talk about it much because we're Gentiles, but I think Acts 15 is still in effect. You know, I think, and isn't that what Paul is doing on his first church planting trip? If you read, and I hadn't noticed it before, you know, it's not like it just appeared, but I just hadn't paid attention before, but one of the things that Paul and Barnabas are out doing, and then ultimately Paul and Silas are going to be doing, is telling people about the decree from the council in Jerusalem. Right? They're sharing what you as Gentiles need to do and what you ought not to do. One of which is what? Don't eat blood. Okay. So I know that's not a popular view, and there are many who would say, no, Acts 15, the decrees there have passed. Now you're picking on rust, right? But we don't like restrictions of any kind. And so we want to defend our appetites or our desires. And I think Acts 15, why would Paul spend years teaching people about what had been decided at the Council of Jerusalem, if it wasn't? You know, I think it is. So there's consequences. You know, we still know, I think, this much scientifically about blood, but the diseases and the consequences You know, we're learning, again, this much about DNA. We're learning, you know, we don't know. God does. And I think there's more than just, there's a variety of reasons why God would why God would have us not partake of blood. But I think it's something that one can participate in ignorance, but once one learns Acts 15, I think that one has a choice to either submit to it or not. And if you deliberately refuse, well, there's a... I'm not convinced that it's a 1 Corinthians or a Romans issue of conscience. I think it's more than that. It's beyond, it's a conscience issue. It's a clear teaching from James and the elders and the pastors there in the church at Jerusalem, what Gentiles should do. So it's... Right. Yeah, and it's not that blood is magical. It's not that blood has supernatural powers. Years ago, who was it that there were those who were teaching that the blood that Jesus shed on the cross was somehow collected and transported to heaven, so his literal blood was in heaven. It's like, well, I don't think that's the point, right? I don't think his blood has superpowers. It's what did it represent? He shed his blood, he died, and suffered the consequences of sin, even though he was innocent. He shed his blood. That's... Yeah. So, but we'll come to that in Acts 15, and why James and the other leaders in Jerusalem make that an issue, I think so. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and look at this. And this is an odd it's such an unusual command that is given to Ezekiel, and it is not because God is heartless. And I would also say that this command to Ezekiel is not mandatory for every believer to follow, right? Just because there's a command in the scriptures does not mean it's directly to you to obey, right? That old song, every promise in the book is mine, every chapter, every verse, every line. And I understand what people are saying there is, but there are commands in scripture that don't apply to me. Right? It doesn't mean that, oh good, I can do... No, it's not that. But there are commands to... specific commands for specific occasions in Scripture that do not relate to other people, right? That other people are not bound to obey. I think this is one. And what I mean by that is this. Ezekiel is called by God to not mourn for the death of his wife. It's okay for believers. In fact, Paul says what? We sorrow. Then he puts that little caveat with it, though. But not as those who have no hope. It's okay to weep. John 11. What does Jesus do, right? Shortest verse in the English Bible, right? Jesus wept. Now, I think he weeps for more than just Lazarus. Right? I think he's weeping also because the people of Jerusalem, after all these years of teaching, are still spiritually dead. Right? And he weeps over that. He weeps over their callous hearts. And I think perhaps to some extent he weeps because he knows in a very short period of time the leaders of Jerusalem are going to try to kill Lazarus, right? Make him dead again, right? Poor guy. So I think there's a lot of reasons, but Jesus weeps. He expresses grief. Ezekiel is called to not. I think that would be an incredibly difficult thing to do. This morning for breakfast, I moved my wife to tears. So maybe she has that experience every morning I get out of bed. But she, you know, my wife was moved to tears. Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry. But we were just talking about death. You know, it's a natural, normal, righteous thing to do, to weep when you lose a loved one. But listen to what God says to Ezekiel. And again, not because God is heartless, not because God is this callous, don't need to weep over anybody. That's not the issue. Let's read through this. Verse 15 through 17. And the word of Yahweh, notice now it has become the word of Yahweh and not Adonai Yahweh. The word of Yahweh came to me saying, Son of man, behold, I am about to take from you the desire of your eyes with a blow. In other words, God is going to cause the death of his wife. But notice, she is what? The desire of his eyes. Okay? And I don't think I'm the only husband who, when he sees his wife after a period of absence, whose heart goes a little aflutter and is glad to see my wife, right? This is Ezekiel. But you shall not mourn. Wow. You shall not mourn, you shall not weep, and your tears shall not come. Groan silently. Make no mourning for the dead. Bind on your headdress, put on your shoes, put your shoes on your feet, and do not cover your mustache. See, it's biblical. Biblical. Right? You're just being biblical, growing. Or as Spurgeon said, be a man and grow a beard. But do not cover your mustache and do not eat the bread of men. I'm not entirely sure what that expression means. But the point is this. Do not publicly weep at the loss of your wife. In fact, he says, don't even cry. Isn't that almost an impossible thing to do? I know that's what parents tell your kids. Now quit crying. Right? Right? And I'm saying, well, okay. It's hard to shut off tears, right? Especially when there's genuine sorrow. So, that's the instruction. Verses 18 through 24. So I spoke to the people in the morning, and in the evening my wife died. And in the morning, I did as I was commanded. Wow. See, that's a step of faith. That is an incredibly difficult step of faith. And the people said to me, will you not tell us what these things that you are doing mean for us? Then I said to them, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, say to the house of Israel, thus says Adonai Yahweh, behold, I am about to profane my sanctuary. Now, again, who profaned the sanctuary? Babylonians did. Who profaned the sanctuary? Israel started it, so to speak, right? But who profaned his sanctuary? God did. Okay? You understand the levels that we're talking about here, right? Israel has profaned it, doing all these horrible things that we've witnessed so far in the book of Ezekiel. You've already profaned it. Babylon is coming, and they're going to, can you re-profane something, right? They're going to profane it again. And God is saying, ultimately, I am the one who is going to cause the profaning of my sanctuary. In other words, what? I'm done with that temple, right? The pride of your strength. We got the temple. What do you got? Right? That was the thing. In fact, what does he call it? The desire of your eyes. Well, haven't we heard that? Just a couple verses before. Isn't that how God described Ezekiel's wife? There was a love, there was an affection for the temple, similar to a husband and wife's affection. And the delight of your soul, and your sons and your daughters whom you have left behind will fall by the sword. And you will do as I have done. You will not cover your mustache, and you will not eat the bread of men. And your headdresses will be on your heads and your shoes on your feet. You will not mourn and you will not weep, but you will rot away in your iniquities and you will groan to one another. And thus Ezekiel will be a wondrous sign to you according to all that he has done. You will do when it comes. In other words, what? The grief that you will experience when you hear the news of the destruction of Jerusalem, and in particular the temple, will be greater than the loss that a husband or a wife experiences at the loss of their spouse. Okay? That's the idea. And what does he say then? Then you will know that I am Adonai Yahweh. Let's back up to the book of Jeremiah. We have time to do this. Jeremiah chapter 16 tells us just a glimpse of what it was to mourn in their culture. Jeremiah chapter 16, and beginning in verse 5, thus says Yahweh, do not enter the house of the funeral meal, or go to lament, or to console them, for I have withdrawn my peace from this people, declares Yahweh. My loving kindness and compassion, both great men and small, will die in this land. They will not be buried, they will not be lamented, nor will anyone gash himself or shave his head for them. Those are things that were done, right? Verse 7, men will not break bread in mourning for them to comfort anyone for the dead, nor give them a cup of comforting, which I think is probably should be spelled coffee. No. A cup of comforting to drink for anyone's father or mother. But you see, that's the normal process, okay? So when God says to Ezekiel, I'm going to take your wife. Now, we don't know, I don't think, anything else about Ezekiel's wife, but it's possible she was a believer. So if God takes her, she enters into what Jesus refers to as Abraham's bosom, right? She enters into if you will, the happy, blessed, joyful part of Sheol, right? So good for her, bad for Ezekiel, right? Grief for Ezekiel, but unexpressed grief. Now, the normal mourning customs, God says to Ezekiel, don't do what you're accustomed to do. Now, we live in a culture that has a number of customs when somebody passes, right? When somebody dies. And it's just expected, right? I was surprised recently somebody didn't follow a custom. And it's like, you can't do that. It's like, well, actually, you can. Right? But that ain't normal. You're supposed to do it this way. I confess that was in my heart. But it turned out that as I read a little bit more in this communication was he didn't want to be the focus. So he said, no service. Said, but you can't. Right? So you can imagine now, here's Ezekiel's wife has passed away, and you're familiar with Middle East culture that when somebody dies, oftentimes they're buried the same day, right? And there's great weeping and wailing, and there's, in contemporary Middle East, there's the parade through the streets, and the coffin is carried, and everybody is, you know, and Ezekiel is said to, right? And that's going to stand out. What's with you? Right? You didn't shave your head. Right? You've kept your mustache. You're not eating. We brought this hot dish over, right? Because we're from Minnesota. But if from elsewhere, you know, we brought a casserole to you. But whatever, but we brought this and you're not eating. What did we do wrong? Right? You understand what's happening here? Dyer's comment again, I thought he had this second helpful idea here in his commentary, that they were not to mourn and weep, not because they were not sad, but because the magnitude of the destruction would render grief inadequate. I mean, how many tears should you shed? How many decibels loud should you express your grief? How many loaves of bread should you eat? How many hot dishes should you eat? Right? How many hours should you sit at the funeral home? Right? Yeah, and I don't understand where I'm going with that. How much is enough? The destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Again, the temple has been the place that God has chosen for his name to dwell, right? That's how it's described. This is where I have chosen my name to dwell. And now God says, it's going to be gone. I'm going to not only erase it, I'm going to profane it before it's erased. And how much can you grieve over that? So, Ezekiel is an object lesson, but a painful one, right? The grief is still there. Now, for those who are armchair psychologists and psychiatrists, this is not damaging to Ezekiel, right?
Well, you just need to let it out, Ezekiel.
No. God says not, right? And it's not going to warp him for the rest of his life. We got to be really careful how we approach this. God is not telling him to walk through the five stages of grief. or 7 or 3, whatever your favorite psychologist has said there is. God knows far more about us than we do, right? He knows far more about grief than we will ever know. And if he says to Ezekiel, do not outwardly mourn the loss of your wife, that's the right thing to do, right? That's the holy thing to do, as hard as that will be. Well, that leads us then, lastly, verse 25 through 27, and then we'll see if you have any questions. Now, as for you, son of man, will it not be on the day when I take from them their strong defense, the joy of their beauty, the desire of their eyes? There's that expression again. Isn't that the third time we've seen that? And what lifts up their soul, their sons and their daughters, that on that day he who escapes will come to you with a report for your ears. Somebody had to travel, right? It's not like they could watch it on MSNBC, right? Or CNN or Fox News. Somebody literally had to travel from Jerusalem all the way to Babylon and say, Jerusalem has been destroyed. And that can take 4 months, right? So read Ezra and Nehemiah talks about how long it took to go from Jerusalem, Babylon, and so on. That's a long time. You're getting the news long after the event, right? It's just like when somebody says, hey, did you hear so-and-so died last week? And you go, no, I didn't hear that. Well, this is, I didn't hear that, and it's been 4 months, right? On that day, God says to Ezekiel, when you hear the news, your mouth will be opened to him who escaped, and you will speak and be mute no longer. And thus you will be a wondrous sign to them, and they will know that I am Yahweh. So Ezekiel's silence is going to last, and I've typed it in there for you. You can look it up, chapter 33 and verse 21. But Ezekiel is going to be silent for a long period of time. Now, if I'm understanding this accurately, here's a man who has had this exceedingly contrary ministry, right, among the people of Israel. And he knows that the temple in which he had perhaps had served or was aware of is going to be destroyed. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. The people of Israel are going to be destroyed. And he's been ministering and having a faithful ministry without necessarily having a fruitful ministry, so to speak, right? We're going to see that later on in Ezekiel, in where he talks about how people come to him as if he's this great entertainer, right? And now his wife, we're making an assumption here, but it's fairly safe to say that if Ezekiel and Mrs. Ezekiel are anything like most couples, they would probably sit down and talk about, how did your day go? Well, went out and preached, and yeah, that's what happened yesterday, wasn't it, dear? Yep. And it'll happen tomorrow. And now her voice is silent, right? She's no longer there for Ezekiel. And the difficulty of this, and then God has called him to be silent now for roughly 4 months, right? At least, probably, at least publicly silent. I don't know if he was, and who else is at home? We don't know. I just find this to be a really difficult command. Right? This has got to be extremely difficult to obey. Now again, not in the sense of violating what John says in 1 John, that God's commandments are not burdensome. It's not burdensome in that sense. I'm just saying, I think this ranks really close to Abraham. Take your only son and go up to Mount Moriah. I think it ranks pretty close to that type of a thing. It can be obeyed. It can be obeyed in faith. It can be obeyed by the grace of the God who gave the command. And that's what Ezekiel is called to do. Painful in so many ways. Difficult in so many ways. All right. Before we go on to the next page, and I do want to go through the next page real quick. Any questions or comments on that? What we've looked at with Mrs. Ezekiel and Mr. Yes. Yeah. So if you weren't able to hear that, Connie's reference or testimony of the peace which God grants in connection with Philippians 4, a peace which passes all comprehension, right? And God does grant that peace. So, yes, thank you. All right, anything else before we just do a this is the fastest I've ever gone through 8 chapters. All right, real quick, page 32. You can read all of page 32 by yourself. But the point of this is, and I'm not going to go through all of these, is that God is going to bring these prophecies to fulfillment against all these nations. And I think the significance of this is that these nations completely surround Israel. So you go to the east with the Ammonites, and the southeast with the Moabites, and the south-southeast with the Edomites. You go to the west, you got Philistia. You go to the north, you got Tyre and Sidon. And you go to the south and the southwest, and you have Egypt. In other words, God is going to deal with all of these nations, and they're the judgments that come upon them, and we'll see this later on where God brings a special judgment upon the people of Edom, because when Babylon came into Jerusalem and brought destruction upon Jerusalem, the Edomites stood by and cheered, right? The Edomites said, well, God says, you have coveted the land of Israel. And because of that, and because of your attitude, because you did nothing to defend my people, and are you not relatives? Right? Descendants of Esau and the descendants of Jacob. Right? So these prophecies against these Gentile nations, God says, I will bring my vengeance upon you, and thus you will know that I am Yahweh. God is working in all of these different nations. Right? So he's not simply working in Israel, which by itself is this amazing demonstration of grace. But God is also working in all those surrounding Gentile nations. And I'm not going to go through all of those. I just think we can move along through our study here, but we will pick up with chapter 33 next time. I'll have some notes ready for us, but just know that, again, God is working throughout the world, And even though he has focused upon the people of Israel, he is working in other places. And sometimes we don't hear about it. Sometimes we don't see it. We don't read about it. But God is working. And it is always done in perfect justice and perfect wisdom. But you can read through those on your own.